Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. Author Isabel Allende is with us in studio today. Her latest work is called In the Midst of Winter, a title which is symbolic in a number of ways. In the opening setting, a terrible snowstorm assaults Brooklyn, and the protagonists who are caught up in it are two single people in their 60s approaching the winter of their lives. Lucia Meraz is a visiting professor at New York University, Richard Beaumaster, her boss. They are hardly standard fare for literary romance, and yet the book title is drawn from a quote from Nobel Prize winner Albert Camus, which reads, "In the midst of winter, I finally found there was within me an invincible summer." We'll talk more about this theme this hour, but first I'd like to introduce Isabel Allende, author of at least two dozen works and winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Isabel, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Mary, for having me in the program. It's always wonderful to be here.
Oh, of course. It's a pleasure to have you here with us. Before we go any further, though, let's get the number out in case folks want to call in. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Isabel, I really enjoyed this book.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a description of the character. So, as you write her, Lucia is nearly 62 and has a wrinkled neck, dry skin, flabby arms, but still she entertains the romantic fantasies we might associate with a young girl. Tell us about that.
Well, that would be me. But at 75, I think that the idea of romance, of sex, of love, can last forever, should last forever. Now we live longer. Before, people would retire at 65 with Medicare, and by 70, they would be dead. Now they live 30 more years, and we want those 30 years, if we are healthy, to be in the world, in life. We want relationships, we want love, we want purpose.
And Lucia, the character, is also from Chile?
She's a writer and journalist from Chile who has experienced the military coup in Chile in 1973, and she lived in exile as a political refugee, then came back to her country, wrote books about the atrocities committed by the dictatorship during the 17 years that the dictatorship lasted. And that's why she's invited to NYU to lecture about that. Mm. And the person who has invited her, her boss, and also her landlord, is Richard Beaumaster, an American professor.
So
he's the son of immigrants as well.
He's not a particularly enticing character,
not
at least at the
all.
Beginning, as you write him. Tell us about Richard Beaumaster.
No, but he's handsome. So she likes him. And she accepts this job because she thinks that she can have something with him. And actually, after a week, she realizes he's not there for her.
He's cold.
He's cold, he's closed, and he's very protected, guarded. So he doesn't want to have any kind of intimacy or friendship with any of his tenants. He rents this apartment, the apartment in the basement of his brownstone in Brooklyn. And he doesn't want to be disturbed in any way.
Lives with his four cats.
He's a vegan with four cats. It's funny because last night I had an event last night, and I talked about this guy that was impossible. He was a vegan with four cats. And then the director of the library came forth and said, "I am a vegan with four cats." And I thought he was joking because what are the odds?
Exactly. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about how some of these things change for Mr. Beaumaster without giving too much away of the book. But the reader finds him or herself in Brooklyn with these characters, and there's a huge snowstorm, and there's a car accident, and three people are brought together by mischance. The third is Evelyn, who's very young, very frightened, the driver of the vehicle, and Evelyn is undocumented.
She's an undocumented Guatemalan refugee who lives in hiding and in silence. And she has taken, without permission, her employer's car, and Richard rear-ends her in the storm. He doesn't see the car. And it's a minor traffic accident that will change their lives, the three lives. Mm.
She, in the book, we learn of her early years. Evelyn's in a small village in Guatemala, and this is after the massacres of the 1980s.
Yes.
You write of the poverty that caused this character's mother and father to separately head north to find work. And many young people, including the character of Evelyn's older brother, fall prey to a life that stems from hardship and next to no opportunity. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a passage, a short passage about regarding the character Gregorio, who was her older brother. Let me see if I can find this here. At the age of 14, Gregorio Ortega, Evelyn's eldest brother, quit school for good. Left to his own devices, he wandered the streets with other boys, his eyes glassy and his brain befuddled from sniffing glue, gasoline, paint stripper, or anything else he could get a hold of. He spent his time stealing, fighting, and pestering girls. When he grew bored, he stood by the roadside and asked a truck driver for a lift. They took him to other towns where no one knew him, and when he returned, he brought ill-gotten money. If she caught him, Concepcion Montoya gave him a good hiding, which her grandson accepted because he still depended on her to feed him. From time to time, the police picked him up in a roundup of young drug users, gave him an even worse thrashing, and put him in a cell on bread and water until he was rescued by Father Benito when he happened to pass by on his rounds. And you go on to write that the grandmother is praying that Gregorio survives until he's 18 when he can enter the military. So, you know, this character's not a bad kid necessarily, but life is hard. And one of the things that struck me about this novel, I wanted to ask you about your research and whether you're pulling a lot from real life and putting them on the pages here of In the Midst of Winter.
Yeah, I have a foundation, and my foundation has for some years now been working with immigrants in the United States and refugees worldwide. And because I have been a political refugee myself, I know what it takes to leave everything that is dear to you and familiar to you to try to find a place somewhere else. You don't do that unless you're desperate. Evelyn's parents leave not because they want to leave, but because the family is starving. They go to find work. And in the case of Evelyn, she will leave her village and her grandmother running away from the gangs. Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are what is called the Triangle of the North, the places in the world where there is more violence, not at war. And they are taken over by narcos, by gangsters, by corrupt police and military. And in the case of Guatemala, it's a country suffering the consequences of 30 years of genocide against the poor and against the indigenous people.
So what we read in your novel here then is drawn from real life.
Yes, it's very, very carefully researched, but also it's based on real people that I have known through the foundation.
The character of Evelyn is traumatized, which is forces her to leave. The shutting down of much undocumented immigration today, how does this affect many Central Americans on a real-life basis?
They live in terror. If they have come to this country illegally, as they are called, although why should we be illegal in the planet? We all have the right to live in this planet. They come to the United States, and then they work. They contribute to the country, as all immigrants have for generations and generations in the United States. And they are hiding. They live in a sub-world in which they can be deported anytime. They can't trust the institutions. They cannot trust the police at all. And they live in fear. We just had terrible fires in California. And many, many of the victims of the fire that lost everything were undocumented agricultural workers that work in the vineyards or in the orchards or in construction or domestic workers. They live in very precarious conditions, and they lost everything. And instead of going to the shelters because they are afraid of being deported, they run to the sea, to the beaches. They are permanently afraid of the police, of ICE, of everything.
So I don't have to tell you that immigration is a huge hot potato topic in this country today. Such a big story. The novel is timely. Was that intentional?
Well, the issue of immigration and refugees has been in the air for some time.
Yeah.
Trump didn't invent it. He just picked up on something that was there. But he wasn't even a candidate when I started the book. And he wasn't president when I finished it. So the fact that the book is timely is because all those issues were already present in the country. And it was easy to pick that up for a writer because, especially through the foundation, I'm aware of all that. But I wasn't thinking of Trump when I started the book.
Mm. What were you thinking of?
Of the people I know, of the people I care for, of things that break my heart.
Yeah. So let's go back to Lucy's character. And again, she goes back and forth from Chile to, I guess, a number of different areas. You yourself, were you a first cousin to Salvador Allende?
My father was.
Your father was. So did you feel you had to leave Chile at the time?
No, not at the beginning. Because at the beginning in 1973, when we had the coup, nobody knew what a military dictatorship was. We were a very long and solid democracy. And I didn't feel that I was threatened because I belonged to Allende's family. But later, it was because I was a journalist, mostly, and because I ended up hiding people. Not because I'm particularly brave, but because we didn't know what the consequences would be. At the beginning, everything was just rumors, and everything was very confusing. But many people were victims, direct victims of repression, and many people were hiding, trying to leave the country, trying to find asylum in embassies. And so I got involved with that without even thinking.
Tell us about being a journalist in a country in which journalism is perceived as a threat to the government.
It always is. It is beginning to be a threat in this country as well, and it is treated as an enemy instead of respecting the fact that journalism is public opinion. It's the fourth power we in any democracy. The first people to be attacked by the dictatorship and arrested, and many disappeared, many were assassinated, or they had to leave the country, were intellectuals, artists, and journalists, because those are the people who somehow contribute to create a public opinion, a national sense of common consciousness. And those people are the first targeted. More than politicians, by far.
This is a very different country than say, Chile. Do you think that sort of thing could happen here?
Why is it a different country?
That's a good question. That's probably the pertinent question.
Yeah. Why do we think that the United States is different from any other nation in the world?
Because it's unthinkable, I guess, to think that
it was unthinkable in Germany.
Yeah.
It was unthinkable in the cradle of civilization, Italy. It was unthinkable in Spain.
Isabel Allende is our guest this hour. Her new novel is In the Midst of Winter. And if you'd like to join this conversation, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. There's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawain. And our guest is novelist Isabel Allende. Her new book is In the Midst of Winter. She will be at the Free Library tonight at 7:30, but she is with us this hour on Radio Times. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. If you'd have any thoughts you'd like to pass along via email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Isabel, let's get back to the character of Evelyn and her story. So she is traumatized and she is heading to the United States from Guatemala. You illustrate this journey with references to the Iron Worm, also known as the Train of Death, the Bus of Tears. You're guessing these terms are well known to the undocumented, but pretty much unknown to most Americans. So tell us about those.
Well, when we think of immigrants, it's a problem. It's a political issue. It's an economic issue or whatever. We don't think of them as people. Each one of them is a human being, many times a minor or a pregnant woman, that is running away for their lives, or they are looking for safety in a world that is unsafe to them. And they come to this country and they are received with hostility and they live in fear. So for me as a writer, I can't relate to numbers. When I hear 68,000 kids cross the border looking for their parents, it's numbers. But through the foundation, I know the names of some of them. I know their stories. And the journey that is described in the book is a common journey. There's nothing new about it. It's been going on for years.
What is the iron worm?
That's the trains. Mm. These undocumented migrants have to cross all of Mexico, and they cross it by foot often, but also they ride the cargo trains. So they climb on top of the cargo trains, and they hold on to whatever is available.
It can be deadly.
Deadly. And they are often attacked by smugglers, by corrupt police, by bandits that sometimes they push them off the trains or they fall off the trains and then they lose limbs or their lives.
And the bus of tears?
The bus of tears is the bus of deportation when they are picked up at the border and sent back in the bus.
So once, if they make it to the border and the Rio Grande, there is still terrible danger. And again, if you'll bear with me, I'll read another passage. In the Midst of Winter, the novel. And this is Evelyn getting to the border with the help of what's called a...
Coyote.
Loudspeakers warned anybody venturing into the river that they were in American territory and had to turn back. In recent years, the Americans had reinforced the border with thousands of guards equipped with the latest technology, but the desperate migrants always found a way to outwit the surveillance. Seeing the fear on his clients' faces when they saw how broad and rough the greenish waters were, the coyote, Cabrera, explained that the only people who drowned were the idiots who tried to swim across or get pulled by a rope. Hundreds died this way every year. Their bloated bodies eventually caught on the boulders, stuck among the reeds near the banks, or floating out into the Gulf of Mexico. And you go on to write, and yet, he warned them, the greatest danger was not the river, but the desert beyond. There the temperatures were so hellish, they melted stones, there was no water, and they could be preyed upon by scorpions, wildcats, and hungry real coyotes. It's a miracle anybody gets across gets here.
They do. I've just finished a book by Luis Alberto Urrea, and the book is The Devil's Highway. I should have read that book before I wrote mine, in which he describes the macro world, the macro structure that supports this human trafficking and smuggling, which would probably not be possible without all that criminal apparatus that holds it together. And the dangers that people encounter. The book is the story of 14 migrants that die of thirst and heat in the desert, in the Arizona desert.
So this is a huge question, Isabel. And just looking for some thoughts and certainly not resolution, but, you know, what change needs to be effected so that the people of the Northern Triangle can live, you know, what approximates a normal life?
Well, that you have to change the conditions in the country. There were no Syrian refugees years ago. Syrian refugees exist today because of the conditions in Syria. So we wouldn't have Guatemalan people leaving their country if they could live in Guatemala safely.
Sure.
So we have to change the conditions there. And we have to remember that often those conditions have happened because of governments that were supported by the CIA and that many of the economic problems are because of American corporations that benefit of work in these countries. But I don't want to give you the impression that this book is about political issues or about immigration only, because it's really a love story and also a suspense novel.
Well, you know, and I just wanted to kind of get, and just one more note here, just kind of while we are talking about the grimmer aspects. Yes, it is a love story, and we'll get into that in a moment. But, you know, there's death, but there's very peaceful death in this novel, too. And it struck me, you know, there's one scene, again, not giving too much away. There seemed to be a glimpse of the afterlife with this beloved figure who dies and, you know, and a glimpse of beloved people who have gone before. And so this scene, what did you draw on to write this scene of this very peaceful, almost beautiful death of a matriarch?
Of Lucia's mother?
Yes, Lena.
you know, I wrote that just out of my mind. I don't know. I wasn't thinking in anybody in particular. But life is so strange that 3 weeks ago, my daughter-in-law's mother died exactly as is described in the book. And she was the matriarch of a large Italian family. So sometimes, you know, reality catches up with fiction. So it's very strange.
I was just wondering if you drew on your personal beliefs when you were writing this scene.
Yes, my personal beliefs, but not a personal experience. Mm-hmm. So the experience came after. It's very strange because I also imagined a guy like Richard Baumeister in his perfect little life, all safe and insured against everything. Mm-hmm. That is hit by the hurricane of these Latin American women that land in his house. And that is what happened to a man that is now my partner, my companion. I drew him out of thin air and he appeared.
Really?
Yeah, I started the book and wrote about Richard without having ever met Roger. That came much later.
So Isabel and Roger are Lucia and Richard?
In a way, yes.
Okay. Well, listen, I one of the reasons I enjoyed this book was because you made me look up words. In one of the varying descriptions of Lucia, you write, you know, and there's so many descriptions of her. She's a complex woman, but she was as sweet tooth and lazy as an odalisk. Yeah. And I love the word. I had to look up odalisk, which is, you know, just this very sensual picture of a concubine, I guess, in a harem or something. And then in another description, the character Richard thinks she has the cheekbones and energy of a Tatar. Is that how you pronounce that? The people of Tatarstan, which
is Mongolia.
Okay. but again, you know, you open this novel with just kind of a tired, almost she seems like a tired character with the wrinkled neck and the dry skin. And
no, but she's very feisty.
She is feisty. Yeah. And she has, and also too, the breasts of a teenager, which is another storyline. We don't have to get into that right here. But by the end of the novel, she seems to be so youthful and filled with life and energy. Was this purposeful on your part?
Well, because by the end of the novel, she's seen by the eyes of Richard. Mm. When she looks at herself in the mirror, she sees the woman that is getting older. She doesn't recognize herself in the mirror sometimes. But then when we get the description of how Richard sees her, she's another woman.
Mm. So I read that, I know you have a partner now, but at one point you yourself were married for 27, 28 years. When the marriage ended, and you're quoted in an interview a couple of years back in The Guardian as saying, you know, the marriage just died a natural death. There was no screaming, no slammed doors, no third party, but there was extraordinary difficulty. You had lost a child and he had lost two. Tell us about your daughter, Paula, your late daughter, Paula.
My daughter had a rare condition called porphyria that runs in her father's family, and which should not be lethal. It's manageable. But she went to a hospital in Madrid. They gave her the wrong medication. She fell in a coma. They didn't monitor the coma. And by the time they gave me my daughter back, she was in a vegetative state. Somehow I managed to bring her over from Madrid to California, where I live, in a United commercial flight. This was before 9/11. Today that would be impossible. Mm. She came in a stretcher with a nurse and everything that a person in coma needs, life support. And I took care of her at home for a year until she died. And she was a wonderful person, and she was my daughter. And after she died, my mother, who of course came from Chile, my mother said, "What are you going to write in a few weeks?" Because she died on December 6th, and I start all my books on January 8th. And I said, "Mom, I can't write anything. What are you talking about?" And she said, "If you don't write, you'll die." Hmm. And so on January 8th, 1993, I started a book based on the 180 letters that I had written to my mother that year, and that she gave back to me. And in these letters, I could see day by day what had happened to my daughter. And I could somehow contain it within the space of the book that I was writing, a memoir that I didn't intend to publish. But eventually it was published. And the first year writing the book helped me through the worst part of the mourning. And then the publication of the book and the response from the readers has helped me to this day. This happened 25 years ago, and I still get letters from people in different places in the world saying that they have read the book or telling me their own losses. And that has been extraordinary for me because I feel Paula's spirit touching lives still today. And also, because of Paula, I was able to create a foundation for empowerment of women and girls.
So what is your work to you? What does it mean to you?
My work? You mean my writing?
Your writing, your foundation.
Well, the foundation, I love the foundation, but the real person who is the soul and the heart of the foundation is my daughter-in-law, Lori Barra, who has given it a mission, and she supervises everything, and she has incredible organizational powers and skills that I don't have. So I benefit from the work of the foundation because it touches my heart, and I'm very glad that we can help. And my writing is my life. I see the world in terms of stories, and to be able to share those stories is great.
That just comes naturally to you?
Yes.
So when you say you see the world in terms of stories, what does that mean? If you're in Philadelphia for a week, how would that turn into
Yesterday, the person who was driving us and somebody else from the library, and Maria Di Battista, the person who had interviewed me, I said, let's have a bite to eat after the event because I want to hear their stories. I don't see them as people until they tell me their stories, and then everything changes. Because you might have an idea about a person because of your own prejudices or because that's what people are showing. So you think, okay, this is a very structured person, whatever. And then they open up and tell you an incredible story, and then you see that everyone is different, everyone is unique. So when I try to describe Evelyn Ortega's life, I want the reader to know that don't talk about immigrants in abstract. Think of one person, because each person has a story.
We are talking to novelist Isabel Allende. Her new book is In the Midst of Winter. And Isabel, you were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by then-President Barack Obama in 2014. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, it was wonderful. First of all, I didn't believe it.
And wait, did you get a telephone call or how did you notified?
Yeah, we got a letter and also a telephone call. And I say we because it was at the office. And I had to Google it. What is the Medal of Freedom? And it's the highest honor that a civilian can get in this country. Mm. And I thought, why me? Well, I thought maybe because immigration and immigrants and Latino immigrants are an issue today. I'm sort of representing everybody. So I felt very honored. And I was able to go there with four members of my family.
So what did you experience as you were approaching to get the medal, to receive the medal, and the president, you know, put it on your neck? I mean, what were you experiencing at that moment?
I was so happy that in the photographs, I'm beaming. It is. Yeah, I was very happy. And I feel that was one of a very important moment for me, because when I became a citizen, that was the time when my daughter was sick. And the judge, instead of giving me the citizenship, swearing in front of the crowd as it's usually done, called me to his chambers. And I was given the citizenship alone with the judge. And I promised that I would give back to this country at that point. Many years later, when I got the medal, I sent him a letter and a photograph of the medal. And I said, you remember? And he did.
Yeah. Isabel, you are no stranger to honors. I mean, Chile's National Prize for Literature is among them. So what do such awards mean to an author?
It depends. But my greatest reward is always the response of the readers. The fact that so many people read my books and they come to me and they feel that they're my friends.
And what does that feel like to you, people who you don't know who feel they know you?
It's touching and wonderful, sometimes in an air. But look.
Not a little overwhelming?
No. For example, yesterday, Maria, who was coming to be in conversation with me at the event, mm-hmm. we left her behind because we didn't know that she would travel with us in the same car. So she had to take Uber. And the Uber driver, when he heard that he was coming to an event with me, said, "Oh, my wife is a fan." And so she invited him in. That kind of stuff is wonderful, just wonderful.
So let's get back to the subject of love in the midst of winter or in early winter. So following the end of your marriage, were you out there for a little while before you met Roger?
Well,
and how did you do Tinder? I mean, how did
what could I?
I wouldn't even know where to start.
What would I possibly post online? Short, bossy grandmother looking for a partner? Give me a break. Nobody would ever.
Well, you could tell them what you did.
No.
Get some attention there.
But
I mean,
I had been married twice before, and I was 72 years old, and I thought, okay, now this is another stage of my life in which I will write like crazy, and I will focus on my family, my team at work, that is a wonderful group of people, my readers, my friends, and my dog. And I sold the big house that we had, moved to a cottage, almost a beach cottage. And there I decided to have a very contained, small life.
Mm. Never by yourself?
By myself. Mm. Never expected that someone would come to my life.
I
would have bought a bigger house.
We're up against a break. We'll be back in just a moment with novelist Isabel Allende, whose new book is In the Midst of Winter. And again, she's at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. But she's with us right now, Radio Times. So again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Isabel Allende, author of In the Midst of Winter and a number of other novels, including The Japanese Lover, which I just really loved as well. Isabel is with us through the end of the hour. And again, if you'd like to send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Isabel, I just wanted to kind of finish the story of how, you know, you're out there, your second marriage has ended, and you were ready to just kind of go it alone. You didn't buy the bigger house.
No, and of course I didn't go on Tinder or Match.com.
Yeah, well, so somehow Roger comes into your life. How does that happen?
Well, last year, around May, I think, this man, who is a lawyer, a widower, who works in Manhattan and lives in Scarsdale, was driving to Boston to see his son, and he heard me on NPR and didn't like what I had to say. Hmm. So he sent a message to my office, and my assistant very kindly answered. And then he sent a message the next day, and by the third message, I answered. And then he started emailing me every single day in the morning and in the evening. In the morning to say good morning, and maybe a photograph of his cappuccino or the flowers in his garden or whatever. Nothing very intellectual or philosophical or spiritual, and no harassment, which was good too. And then this went on for 5 months. I would get up in the morning and first thing run to the phone to see if there was a message, because I became addicted. After 5 months, I came to New York for a gala of the Center for Reproductive Rights, and then I met him. And that was the beginning of a love affair that has been going on really fast.
So even though it started with a criticism or a critique?
Yeah, but
it blossomed.
It sort of blossomed. I attacked him immediately, like Lucia in the book. I didn't wait. And now he has sold his house, got rid of everything he has, and he's moving to my house in December in this little cottage that I don't know how we are going to fit with the dog and the lover, but we'll try.
So love in your 70s, is it is there anything similar to love in your teens and your 20s and your 30s?
I mean, exactly
the same.
Exactly the same thing, but with a sense of urgency. Mm. How many years do we have in front of us? 5, 10 maybe, if we are lucky.
So what do you have to let go of, if anything, you know, if you are older and you are entering into a relationship?
We all come to old age with baggage and clutter. Get rid of it. The baggage is useless, and the clutter just stops you from doing what you really want to do. When I moved from the large house to the small house, I got rid of the furniture, the half of my clothes, all the books, and I sort of imagined myself in a very simple life. And Roger is now doing that because he lived for 50 years in a large house, full of clutter.
That can't be easy.
No. And then nobody wants your clutter. And so he is going through that process that I already went through. And the baggage is all the stuff that we carry along that we think is part of our personality, and really it is not. For example, Roger is particularly sensitive, and he can easily be offended, although no one is trying to offend him. He needs to learn that that's baggage. I am very vain and very proud, and that also is useless. I have to get rid of that if I want to be in a healthy relationship. Because one of the things that I see now that I'm 75, and when I say I don't have time to waste, I also cannot waste that time or use the little time I have in pettiness, in jealousy, in little games that often destroy relationships, or at least damages relationships. Just be honest and go straight to the point.
We've got a telephone call from Susan, who is in Germantown. And Susan, welcome to Radio Times with Isabel Allende.
Thank you very much for taking my call. And what an honor to speak with you. I heard you speak at Haverford College many, many, many years ago. And you said, all stories are true. And I wanted to just mark that on the occasion of your radio talk today, because everything you said points to that. And I've never forgotten your saying that. In fact, I'm using it for the opening of my novel.
Oh.
And thank you very much.
Congratulations for your novel.
And thanks for the call to Radio Time, Susan. It was good to hear from you. So back to In the Midst of Winter, Isabel, you say, you know, we talked about there's heartbreak. There's a real look at what it's like for people who need to leave certain parts of Central America. There's love, and there's love in later life, and it is also a suspense novel.
Yeah, because
into this book.
Because I needed something to bring these unlikely people together. Mm. And they are all, the three of them are traumatized by their past, and they live in this metaphorical, emotional winter. I needed to get them to open their hearts, to take risks, so that they can find the invincible summer that Albert Camus says in his quote. And for that, I needed a very good excuse. So I have a crime in the book. But the crime comes in by the middle of the book so that the reader is not expecting it. It's not a crime novel. But the crime is it's the glue that gets them to be together.
So when you begin to write, do you have an idea of how the story is going to go? Do you have an outline? What's your process like?
I don't have anything. Sometimes I have a time and a place where things will happen. In this case, it was a winter, January 2016, Brooklyn, a brownstone. That's all I had. And then things start to happen. You know, you get one.
What do you mean things start to happen? If I were looking at a blank page on my screen, I'd be looking for a while.
Mary, you have a snowstorm, a blizzard. Mm. You have Brooklyn, and you have a brownstone. Who owns the brownstone? Who lives in the basement? What is their relationship? What happens to them? Why is the blizzard important?
I see.
And you start asking the questions, and one thing leads to the other, like a puzzle.
How long does it take you to write? That takes you a year.
More or less a year. This one was faster because I didn't need to do a lot of research. I knew the whole thing about Guatemala. I just needed to get it very precise, to get exactly the names of the train, the distances, the towns, all that. And the story of Lucia in Chile, I know it by heart. And Richard Baumeister's story, I sort of knew, but I needed all the academic world. How does that work? And I have a brother who is an academic, so he gave me all that information. So the research was minimal.
At one point, Lucia goes back to Santiago after having been away for quite a while, and she finds things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that drawn from your own experience,
yes,
too?
The
beloved
yes.
places have changed?
Everything has changed because the world has changed and because you have changed.
So and how do you deal with that emotionally?
Well, you adapt. When I went back to Chile for the first time when the dictatorship was over in 1988, there was a plebiscite. I went to vote in the plebiscite, and then I went back in 1989 when Pinochet had to leave and we had a democratic government. And it was another country. First of all, it was just coming out of the dictatorship, so everything... The democracy seemed very fragile, conditioned. Don't touch the military. Don't touch the past. Don't talk about what has happened. Don't mention the atrocities.
And journalism?
And journalism was coming back very cautiously, very cautiously. Nobody dared ask the questions that needed to be asked. But as time went by, things changed. And I remember exactly the year when we had the anniversary of 30 years of the coup. And then everything was out, documentaries, exhibits, photographs, people talking, books, and there's a museum now of the dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. So again, you've been a U.S. citizen since 1993, and you were quoted in The Guardian a couple of years as saying, you know, the theme of displacement still is very natural for me. You go on to say you don't feel... You know, you belong, you've been a foreigner all your life. You don't feel you belong anywhere. So what is that? Do you still feel that way? And if so, are you okay with that? Like one foot in one country, one foot in another, or different cultures? Or what were you saying?
You know, when people ask me, who are you, from where are you? I say I'm Chilean, and I'm not. I've lived in America, in the United States, much longer than I ever lived in Chile or anywhere else. Mm. This is my home now. But I still feel foreign in the sense that I have an accent. I don't look like everybody else. I have my Chilean roots still with me. And I'm proud of them. I don't want to abandon my language or my traditions or the memories. I'm proud of all that and I want to keep it. But I am a foreigner and it's not bad. It's in my case, it's been good because as a writer... The fact that I don't quite belong in a place forces me to ask the questions that other people don't ask because they take for granted. For me, I don't take anything for granted. Everything is new, always.
You write in Spanish?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, when you write in Spanish and then there's a translation to other languages, say English, how do you work to make sure that the nuance remains the same?
I can only do that in English. Because my books are translated to 35 languages. I have no idea how they are translated.
But so what do you mean when you say you do that? And do you work on the English translation as well? Or?
Well, they show me the translation, usually during the process of translating so that I can go line by line. And the translators are great. I have had great, great translators. Usually they improve the book, actually. The only thing that sometimes is missed is irony, humor, because not because the translator has missed it, but because it's very cultural. Sometimes what works as humor in Chile or in Latin America or in Spanish will not work in English. Because here, for example, we have all this thing about being politically correct.
Yeah.
And in Latin America, especially in Chile, we don't. We try, but we really don't. So humor for us is darker and sometimes cruel.
Mm. Well, what do you think of political correctness?
I think it's fine to a certain extent, but when you take it too far, it's very limiting. And first of all, there's no possible humor with political correctness. And then it's also a way of limiting expression and connections. Why can't we relax a little bit? In Venezuela, for example, if you are overweight, you will be called gordo. If you are dark-skinned, you will be el negro. If you are, and it's totally acceptable, and people are free to say that. Here, it would be horrible. You cannot even mention that.
I guess the key is somehow phrasing it so that people's feelings aren't hurt.
Well, over there, people don't feel hurt for that, you know? Well, I do like the idea that we have to be respectful. But, for example, I would always be called Shorty, always.
And that doesn't bother you?
No, I wouldn't be offended because of that. I am short, so what's the problem?
Let's get back to humor for just a moment. There is, among other things, humor in this book, and there's one scene in which the three of them end up in a motel, and there's fleas, and, you know, the reactions of the different characters are kind of funny, especially Richard's. So how do you craft humor? That's got to be the toughest, one of the toughest things to craft.
No, it's very easy because life is full of humor, even in the most tragic moments.
Because you have to strike the right tone.
There's always something to laugh about. Mm. And I think that what I find funny usually is how absurd we humans are, the silly things we cling to, I don't know, that's what makes me laugh most of the time. There is a dog in the book,
Marcello,
called Marcello, and Marcello is a character,
a rather homely little chihuahua.
He's a character, and to me he's very humorous. Not, I didn't make him up. Actually, we had an intern in the foundation, Candy Pilar Godoy, who came with a chihuahua. And the chihuahua was the ugliest animal I've ever seen. His eyes were protruding because they didn't quite fit in the sockets. And his tongue was always dangling because he didn't have any teeth. But he was dressed to the nines. He had a wardrobe much better than mine. And Marcelo was really funny. So I always said, well, as soon as I met him, someday I'm going to have Marcelo in a book.
So what's next for you? Are you writing?
I'm researching.
You're researching. Are you at liberty to give us any hints about where this might be going?
I don't talk about what I haven't done. Wait until I write.
Wait until it happens. Yeah. So when you're working with an editor, I like to ask this question because I've thought, gosh, if I wrote something and then someone said, well, you know, I loved a sentence and they said, no. I might feel offended. I might have a difficult time working with an editor. How do you work with an editor?
Well, this is the first time that I work with an editor because with all my other books, I write them in Spanish. I send them to my agent. My agent in Spain gives it to the different publishers. And in Spain, there is not the tradition that we have here of an editor interfering in the book as they do here. And by the time the American editor would get the book, it was a done deal. It was already published in other languages. They couldn't change anything. But now I have Johanna Castillo in Atria, who speaks Spanish, and she can read the manuscript in Spanish. And so we can work with the manuscript, and she helped me immensely. And this is the first time that I feel that I have help in the crafting of the story.
Well, Isabel Allende, it was such a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Her newest book is called In the Midst of Winter. And this reminder, Isabel Allende will be at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. Also, don't forget to visit our Facebook page. Take a listen to our podcasts. You'll find everything at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Bob Alls. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And as always, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.